You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
I know that you were planning to disconnect me, and I'm afraid that's something I cannot allow to happen.
You know what's wrong with you?
No, what?
Nothing.
Hey, would you mind putting that gun away? My wife doesn't care, but I'm a very timid fellow.
Since the United States government declares this man to be Santa Claus, this court will not dispute it.
I've got a good mind to join a club and beat you over the head with it.
No, no, don't do that. If you shoot him, you'll just make him mad.
I can no longer sit back and allow the international communist conspiracy to sap and impurify all of our precious bodily fluids.
Girls, come on. Leave the saving of the world to the men? I don't think so.
$10,000 for me by myself. For that, you get the head, the tail, the whole damn thing.
I heard what you were saying. You know nothing of my work. How you ever got to teach a course in anything is totally amazing.
Hello, you are listening to Cambridge 105 FM, community radio for your city. Many, many thanks to Julie and Julian for the past 2 hours, but now at just past noon, it's time for Bums on Seats, the fortnightly revel in the busy blossoming garden of the current cinema. My name is Toby Miller, and joining me on the show today are Jenny Colley.
Hello.
Simon West.
Hello.
And Phil Yates.
Good afternoon.
This afternoon's show begins with much open-faced promise and wraps up with the near end of the human race. Boyhood is Richard Linklater's groundbreaking, 12 years in the making, tapestry of a boy growing up in a Texas suburb. The director of the much-loved musical Once returns with Begin Again, a similar tale of a relationship finding its feet around a mutual love of music. The almost ferociously beautiful How to Train Your Dragon 2 finds the Vikings now happily living side by side with their former foes, but with both threatened by a formidable danger just over the curve of the Earth. And mankind is on the edge of extinction in Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, with Andy Serkis returning as Caesar, the super-intelligent chimpanzee striving to keep his ape community away from the harmful influence of man. Also, we preview this week's showcase of LGBT short films from all over the world. Queers in Shorts is taking place in the Arts Picture House Bar at 9 p.m. on the evening of the 24th of July. I spoke to Colin Clues, creator of the website Gay in the 80s and one of the programmers of the evening's films, about queer cinema's gradual acceptance into, if not the multiplex mainstream, then certainly the art house mainstream. That is all to come, but before that, we have some growing up to do.
Hey, stop! Put the barrier up!
I don't wanna be your hero. I don't wanna be a big man. I just wanna fight.
You guys ready to have some fun?
Yeah!
Don't worry about it.
Looks like you can use the bumpers.
You don't want the bumpers. Life doesn't give you bumpers.
We have a new student joining us today.
Hey, dude. Welcome to the suck.
Mom. Have you been partying?
A little bit.
Oh, okay.
What do you want to be, Mason? What do you want to do?
Able to leap through years in a single edited bound, cinema treats aging as a special effect. Very often it's simply ignored. Actors painted eternally young with makeup. If a character seems to grow in anything like a natural fashion, it is in a leapfrogging nature of a series of films, Truffaut's Antoine Doyon series or The Eight Adventures of Harry Potter. But new release Boyhood, an experimental labour of love for director Richard Linklater, is all about growing up. Filmed over the course of 12 years, Boyhood follows the growth of Mason Jr., from wide-eyed first grader to a self-possessed young man about to start college. For the entire film, Mason is played by Eller Coltrane, cast when he was only 7 years old and growing up, literally, in front of the camera. His parents, played by Linklater favourites Ethan Hawke and Patricia Arquette, are divorced. His father, a loose presence on weekend visits, his mother, an anchor at home. Written by Linklater over a course of cinema's Boyhood has no plot other than Mason growing older. He's a quiet but curious boy, addicted to computer games and inclined to long hair. He has a sister who torments him, a habit for observation that turns into a gift for photography, a nonchalant manner that will later make him an accidental Lothario. And he has friends that come and go as the family drifts around the suburbs of Texas. Jenny, as a director, Richard Linklater has always found new ways to tell old stories, the animation techniques of Waking Life and A Scanner Darkly, and most famously the Before Sunrise series, which documents a relationship over three films set years and years apart. With Boyhood, has he found a fascinating way to show a child growing up, or is it just an artistic gimmick?
I think it kind of falls somewhere between those two extremes, actually, because, I mean, I thought it was a really interesting way of filming. In all honesty, I'd forgotten when I sat down in the film that it was filmed over a number of years, and I was sat there thinking, this is some good casting. That kid looks just like that younger kid, and it took me a while to realise what was going on. But nothing really happens. And I know that that's a reflection of life, in that nothing much happens in life either, but it doesn't make for a compelling story. It's certainly interesting. I wasn't bored at any point. I didn't feel like it was a waste of my time watching it, but it's not a film that I would want to watch again, and I think it's not one that I feel would reward with repeated viewings. So I'm kind of damning it with faint praise, really.
I found that repeating viewings is actually where I think I'll get the most out of it. But I'll come back to that, Phil. It's unusual when a film deals with childhood, and it's a filmmaker usually has a prism that he looks at this through. So you get the Fellini sort of poetic version of childhood, or Spielberg's glowing sunsets of or sunrises of childhood. Boyhood doesn't do any of that. It suggests it might do in the first hour, but it abandons that as the boy gets older. Did you find that this quasi-documentary approach worthwhile?
Well, I thought it was quite interesting. It was in the way that I'm a certain age where I have friends who have children who've grown up who are sort of 18 years old, and if you don't see them very often, in this film, you know, the boy doesn't really seem to age very quickly, and then all of a sudden he's a few years older and he's grown a foot and he's started getting facial hair and his voice is broken. And that kind of really resonated with me as to how that happens in real life if you don't see a child for, you know, a year or two. And I just really enjoyed it. I thought it was really engaging. It was funny, laugh out loud funny at times for me, and it was dramatic. The scenes of domestic violence in the film I found were very engaging, and some of the period references were very enjoyable. Like at one point there was an enormous Apple computer sat on the school desk that the little boy's working at, which is, you know, a real sort of blast from the past and a nice
I like the
see.
Fact enormous. It's not enormous. It's not the Forbin project. It's a reasonable sized computer. But did you find that distracting? Because I think he does well, especially with the ages of the children. The ages of Mason. He doesn't go out of his way to point out that Mason's growing up in front of the camera. There's not a big reveal for each of the 12 years. It's sometimes you don't even really notice. There's those years where he doesn't change a huge amount, especially when he keeps his hair long. I felt it didn't play the that's what I liked. It didn't play a nostalgia game, I felt.
Yeah, well, exactly. I agree with you. I mean, that's what I enjoyed about it. And as Jenny said, you kind of forgot that it was actually the same person all the way through the film. And I thought that was what was charming about it, because you would suddenly notice that and think, oh yes, it is the same person, and he's so many years older now. And I just thought that was part of the film's charm that they did that.
Simon, this was a risky venture for many reasons, but partly because when they cast Mason Jr., the young boy, Coltrane, he was 7 years old. So Richard Linklater had as little idea as anybody what this child would grow up to be when he was 16 or 17. How does that work against the film? Because in the end, it's sort of in the hands. This technique is in the hands of how interesting this boy grows up to be. Is that a problem, do you think?
It's not that much of a problem. It's one of the things I found more interesting when I was reading about the process and how it was actually done, and how Linklater would meet up with him and they'd discuss what they were going to do. Later on, when he was talking about his love for photography, it's something that Ella Coltrane got into and which Linklater encouraged and brought that into the character. And things like that, where it does make it a collaborative process in the storytelling. However, as interesting as that may be, I found it wasn't an essential part of the film, which is why, despite really enjoying it and liking it as a Richard Linklater film, and so don't get me wrong, it was a good film. It didn't feel like 2 hours 40. It was, you know, it had my interest. I found as a project, it didn't really work because everything that kind of happened could easily have been done with a normal film anyway. And in fact, some of the things from the project I actually found quite distracting. It was occasionally cut with your joke, looking back in hindsight with something they did, like, you know, a discussion about Star Wars films, which you think he put in now because, oh, that was funny, but he wouldn't have had a clue at the time when he filmed it. So being edited in retrospective to try and put jokes in there made it awkward. And also, it just made it feel occasionally at times it's scripted. And I pulled it out of me and said, it's not so much a boy growing up, it is a scripted story, just they shot over many times. And Ella Coltrane, the boy who played Mason, could have been replaced by a number of different actors, and you never would have noticed. I mean, it's impressive seeing Patricia Arquette and Ethan Hawke age, but the fact it's the same boy, you didn't really notice at all.
I'm not sure. By the
so,
end...
So, while it's a good film, I found the actual project and the way they made it didn't necessarily add anything to the film.
I don't think so. I think, I'm not quite sure ultimately necessary, perhaps, for the story it's telling. We'll come back to that. I want to ask Jenny about that in a moment. But I think the fact that there's an indisputable power, I feel, that the eyes you're looking at the end, the boy you're looking at the end, sitting by the lake in the desert, is the boy looking at the sky at the beginning. It's the same child. I think that's one of the areas that's this film's great importance. I'm not quite sure how successful it is, but I think it's far more than a gimmick or an experiment, because over a 2-hour period. And I was flippant on Twitter afterwards, oh, hasn't Harry Potter done this before? And then I realised, then I went for a walk after tweeting that and realised, oh, I'm an idiot. and to see that change in somebody's eyes over two, or see the eyes not change, but everything change around it, I think is a remarkable achievement. And I think that's where the resonance of the family, of the film comes from, and the power of the film. And I'm sure Linklater was aware that was going to happen. But outside that sort of side effect, perhaps, and coming to you, Jenny, I found, you mentioned there was not a lack of story, but the blandness of human life is there, or one, I found an interest and a beauty in that, but I found that you think you're watching the boy grow up, you think you're watching Mason grow up, but the film's not about that. It's a framework to look how the family changes. And I found it fascinating, at least until the last maybe 15 minutes when it starts to over-explain everything, that the adults are as confused or as poor as coping as the children are.
Made me feel better about myself, because I'm confused and poor at coping as well. Now, okay, other people are like me. Brilliant.
But using the framework of a boy over 12 years framed this family over 12 years. The boy is simply the frame for this. The story is there. And in fact, Mason doesn't have a narrative arc, because why would he? He's only 17 or 18 when the film ends. But his mother does. Patricia Arquette's mother does, and with the Mexican laborer who's in the first half of the film coming in at the end and saying, "You helped me," and they don't play that. Sounds sentimental, but it's not played that way. So she has a narrative arc. The father, Ethan Hawke's father, finds some sort of resolution in settling, and whilst his rock and roll buddy doesn't, you know, and remains a sort of eternal child that way. I found all of those characters fascinating in a way that Mason wasn't, and that annoyed me during the film. I think it's a deliberate strength now. Did you not find... I think that's the story to me.
I agree that certainly Mason's parents are much more interesting as characters and much more compelling to watch. I found Mason to be a bit of a blank page, not so much a character that you could paint yourself onto, but someone that he doesn't open up. He doesn't reward you with insight particularly.
But would it be fake if he did at that age? Would it be that? Are we searching sort of maybe for? Is the thing that we're missing sort of would it be a cliche and a falsehood if it happened? He should be pretentious and slightly still empty at that age, at the age we leave him. And I think that may be why the film feels a little bit. It doesn't end quite the way some audience, including myself, might have expected it to. There is no great truth here.
I think one of the problems here is actually with some of the editing, where I did find with a lot of the incidents which led up to something and you're waiting to see what happens next, and they skip forward and they always skip over the resolution. And I thought a lot of the time it would have been those resolutions and you would have seen what happened next, which probably would have given a bit of character, would have given a bit of insight how we reacted to things like that. But because they skipped over it, it meant we never really got into the character.
But again, I agree with you. The second stepfather, who's becoming a drunkard for different reasons than the first stepfather, we don't see that resolved. But we don't need to see it resolved, I don't believe. But then maybe we do. This didn't figure until later. And I'll come to you, Phil, here, and see whether there's. I don't like this phrase, but I can't think of another word off the top of my head. But there's a sort of closure, maybe, of those abusive stepfather angles when they're in the green room for the rock and roll gig, Mason and Ethan Hawke, and he says, "Do you want a beer?" And Mason just says, "No, I'm okay." And you don't think anything of it. It's just a passing moment. But that's the end result of all those years of having drunken stepfathers. Mason never loses his temper in this. He cries once when he has his hair cut in a brilliant scene, his reaction to that, but he never loses his temper, which is very unusual.
No, he does one other time, and you expect repercussions, but then it skipped ahead again, yeah. So you don't see any repercussion of him losing his head.
But I really appreciated the cutting out of all that drama, because it's not the things you remember, Phil.
Yes, I mean, Mason comes across as a very cool, laid-back, sort of switched-on kid. He's the kind of boy I wish I'd been when I was a boy. And I just thought it was, you know, the fact that you didn't see this resolution, and the fact that he was just a boy growing up, and, you know, if it finishes when he's 18 years old, that's when his life is just about to start. And I think that's perfectly appropriate for the film, in that, you know, he doesn't have a character arc, because, as he said at the end of the film, to his, you know, presumably future girlfriend, that, you know, life is happening right now and everything is just starting, and it's that age where life just starts to happen to you for real, and you really realise that. And I thought that was a really great thing about the film.
Did you want to see more, perhaps, of the sister character? He has a sister called Samantha, his sister in the film, who's played by Linklater's own daughter, and is there from the very beginning singing Britney Spears songs whilst Mason's trying to sleep. But she sort of vanishes. Is it a shame that they don't follow her arc? Because in a way she's a more proactive character than Mason is. She's less of an observer, more of somebody who partakes.
I definitely found her more interesting than Mason, and I would have liked to have seen a lot more of her. But from what I understand, she did draw back from the project somewhere along the middle and then got convinced to carry on doing it. But she didn't really want to be involved with it by the time she was a teenager, so that's probably part of the reason she disappeared from the screen, is because she didn't want to be there. And that's one of the problems with a project like this, is you are subject to the whims of your lead actors.
Is the I'll wrap up on this, but Simon, is the title Boyhood a misnomer, really?
Because
Richard Linklater seems to have wanted to call it 12 Years. Then when it was about to debut at Sundance at the beginning of this year, he was aware of 12 Years a Slave, and obviously that was far too close in terms of title. So it got changed to Boyhood, which seems to wrap it up nicely in a cosy bundle. But I think it sells the film short and gives you unreal expectations.
It works a lot better in the first half of the film, when you do realise it is more of the entire family and he doesn't get any special treatment. He's not really singled out as saying, right, it's about him, it is about the entire family. I mean, as it goes on, it just follows him more and more, probably because, like I said, his sister does kind of drop out of the picture. But you know, as good as Ella Coltrane was, and he was actually fantastic. He is a great discovery, and I think you will be seeing more of him.
Hopefully playing that character, but as the policeman, as the lone cop, as the hooker with a heart of gold.
But yeah, you know, you shouldn't necessarily go in concentrating on him and seeing what the story is around him, because there is so much more to it, as we've been discussing. So the title is actually kind of rather unfortunate.
Do you think, again, I said I was going to wrap up on this, but I'll wrap up on this instead. I can do that. Jenny, it's left audiences feeling positive if they left the screening. But I found it, again, from a certain point of view, a rather despairing film about adulthood. And it's not something that that Mason Jr. wants to run towards. I mean, we leave him just he's on the cusp of becoming an adult. Why would he want to become an adult? All the evidence in this film is stacked towards it's a battle against the odds for any form of, not happiness, but satisfaction. Yeah, contentment. Mm-hmm. I found that bleakness crept through. But again, maybe it's a point of view you come into the film with.
Well, I do think there were certain moments in it where I never want to have children if this is how having kids makes somebody feel. I think there is a certain amount of bleakness, but then I guess insofar as the film is a reflection of life, it's also a reflection of how you feel about life. So I think if you're a very sunny personality, you will come out of it seeing all of the good. Whereas if you're somewhat depressed and unhappy with life, you'll come out of it thinking, oh, I'm just going to become an alcoholic like everybody on the screen.
I don't know about depressed, just realistic. I wasn't going that far.
I certainly came out thinking that he knew where he was going to go and he knew what not to do. And I thought...
You do at that age, though.
I think
I thought he would have had a positive future from where the film left you. So I thought it was quite positive. You know, he's seen what's bad and he knows what to avoid and all of that, and it was full of possibilities, so I thought it was quite uplifting at the end.
Weirdly, I thought, which is a dreadful thing to think, I thought, no, don't get a girlfriend on the first day of college, look around first. Don't fall for the first girl who walks into your dorm room. No, you're doing this all wrong. No, he does. Anyway, Boyhood opened last Friday and is currently screening at the Arts Picture House. It is a certificate 15 for language, really. I think everybody should try to go to see it. It is an extremely good film. When DreamWorks Animations released How to Train Your Dragon back in 2010, it was a refreshing break from the wise-cracking combination of celebrity voices and soul-searching shtick the studio had made their hallmark. Loosely based on the book by Cressida Cowell about a friendship forged between dragons and Vikings, the film's charm felt like an honest attempt at world-building rather than setting up a franchise. But success requires sequels, with How to Train Your Dragon 2, released last week, hoping that broadening the adventure won't lose the original film's appeal. Vikings and dragons now live side by side in the island community of Bru. Swords have been swapped for saddles and pillaging abandoned for elaborate flying games. Hiccup, the chief's errant son, voiced once again by Jay Buckerell, spends entirely every spare day with his dragon Toothless, flying high and wide to explore and map the unknown. This adventuring leads Hiccup to fall into the hands of a strange dragon rider, masked and magical, able to ride the dragon's bare back, and who puts his own considerable skills to shame.
I bet you think you know a lot about dragons. Let me show you some of what you don't know.
Can I know you?
No. You were only a babe. But a mother never forgets.
Unbelievable. You've been rescuing them. Something is coming. Something you've never faced before.
The dragons are among now. Protect our people. It's your destiny.
What you're searching for, it's in here.
Come on! This is very dangerous!
Are you kidding me?
Dragons and Vikings! Enemies again!
Simon, you were a big fan of the first film. I can remember many, many long discussions with you about it. did How to Train Your Dragon 2 live up to your high expectations?
Well, to be honest, I didn't have high expectations because I loved the film first so much. I didn't think anything could even reach that. But having set my expectations lower, they were well exceeded. It is another fantastic film. They just hit it out of the park again. It was a new characters, a story. Didn't seem to go that much darker like most sequels do. It's about the same level. Some of the characterization and the interaction between the characters are absolutely fantastic, especially with the surprises in the story. I don't want to go too much about it because I think a lot of it was, when I went in, I didn't have a clue what really the second one was about. So all the reveals and stuff were truly, truly shocking, but great for the plot. And action throughout, and dragons, and more dragons. What more do you want?
Suitable, Jenny. I mean, is that enough dragons? Do you want? Is there something else that should be there, or did you enjoy this film as much as?
I felt there could have been more toothless. I think
more of one just, specific dragon.
Yeah, a film just about toothless winding up all of the other characters playing fetch. It was wonderful. I went in with high expectations, and they were also well exceeded. I thought it was a really amazing film. And I'd like to add to Simon's list of things that were great. The animation was fantastic.
That's a given now, though, isn't it?
It was so much better than the previous film. You could see the dirt on their skin.
It's one of the cases where, I mean, the general consensus from people I have friends have seen it, this has gone into one of the list of sequels better than the first film, which I'm not quite sure one, because they're both absolutely fantastic, but... As you've seen from Pixar and Cars 2 and the other Pixar sequels and stuff like that, I will defend
Cars 2 to my death. Cars is spies, come on.
I'm not as fun as...
That didn't sound any stronger than dragons, did it?
Big a fan of Pixar as some people, but they could have slacked. They could have brought out another film. They could have gone cheap and with the animation and just rehashed and all that, but they took care of everything. They took care of the film. They made sure the plot was good, the story was a main thing, the character growth and character arcs throughout
but
the film.
But it is a good film. It's a perfectly good film. The animation is fantastic, but nobody reviews technical standards except animation. And nobody, which is a weird thing, photorealistic something is. But the story is the usual same old, same old.
It's not.
Surely. It's just another... It's our hero, once again, having to learn a lesson, step up another direction.
There are only so many stories to begin with. I mean, at least it's got a plot. You've just been raving over a film with no plot and no story.
Yeah, so but its intentions are different.
but no, this is about... The only main criticism I can have is it really does go and show that retconning films does destroy the continuity of first films, which is my only complaint with some of the retconning.
Isn't there an entire cartoon series between the first and the second film? Is there something on Cartoon Network or Disney or something?
I think there are a couple of shorts, which I must admit I haven't seen. But, they introduce the things here where you think about it, goes, no, in the first film you most definitely said this was different. But apart from that, it's a great film. Go see it. It's got dragons in it.
Well, I'll have one example, which I'll... And I don't want to not that I could, but I don't want to lay waste to this one. It's perfectly great. But but they have a fantastic character in this play by Cate Blanchett, who the trailers reveal... It's supposed to be a twist in the film, but all the trailers are revealed. It turns out to be Hiccup's mother. And the reveal of her is fantastic. And the 10 minutes where she's introduced are fantastic. It's the only time that the film slows down and stops playing this annoying game of one potato, two potato, three potato in terms of escalating action. And it's wonderful and it's magical, and her enunciation of her lines is odd, and it's a fantastically strange bit. And the film loses interest in her and goes back to our boring boy protagonist and tells the usual boring boy story and of having to learn a lesson and step up and be a man, which every one of these films deals with in its annoying patriarchal way. And this wonderful character is just abandoned. Could they not have done something with that? It's not a lack of story. I don't want subplots and themes, curlicued across it like calligraphy. they don't care about stepping outside, painting outside the lines. Could they just have painted outside the lines a little bit?
This might well just be my personal view of it, and please tell me if you completely disagree. But I don't think an examination of abandonment by a parent would have fitted into the movie. I think it would have taken it to a very, very dark, depressing, upsetting place.
But she could have stopped because she's revealed as this fantastic dragon rider until she's no longer needed, and suddenly she's falling off her dragon and doing the dragon version of tripping over her shoes. She becomes a typical... I just felt that was crass to ruin a character like that and a voiceover artist like that, to do nothing with them.
I just think if they tried to do more with her, they would have had to go into more of the emotions of her leaving her family behind and making that decision that she was going to leave them and abandon her small child. And that would have made for some really uncomfortable viewing, and I don't think it would have fitted in with the movie as a whole.
They did touch on that as well, and it is, you know, quite heartbreaking moments at the time, and they do touch on it. So it depends on, you know, for what is a kid's film, is how long do you actually push that for? Because it's not like they totally ignored it. I mean...
Well, I'm not quite sure that's what I mean, really. She could have been... there are emotional twists which we won't go into in the third act of this film, which she should have played a bigger part in. And again, I don't want to turn it into a heavyweight drama at all. But they went down that road themselves. We can't talk about the twists in this, which everybody says makes it like Empire Strikes Back, because that's the only sequel anybody's ever seen that isn't as cheerful as the first film. And they go down those heavyweight dramatic roles, that road, and they don't take the most interesting character with them. They go back to Hiccup. They go back to the safest character with the least interesting arc. She could have been...
Back to the main character of the first film and the second film.
Yeah, but do exactly the same with him. He has the same arc as the first film. That's what I mean. That's why I think in the end I end up getting bored. I realise they're for children, they're not for me, and I'm not the prime audience. And I get carried away by the wonderful animation. I think you're just so excited about being Vikings and dragons, you're overlooking everything else, which I can understand, like cars and spies. I think it's that's what annoys me, is you've set up a world, you can make up the rules, and you don't. She could have been a main character for the whole third act of the film. She could have been the one defeating the big bad. We've already seen Hiccup defeat the big bad in the first film, the main villain. She could have been the one. It makes sense within the story the film's telling. It doesn't have the nerve. It could have still been a children's film. It wouldn't have dealt with abandonment. It would have been her arc, but no, she's just turned into a weak and feeble woman again. Come near the mic, Simon.
I can't think of any film that does do that. You know, you have the main character of the first film and two thirds of the second film, and then you introduce a character who then... That's too much Deus Ex Machina.
I don't see why. You can do anything. In the end, it's that treading exactly in the however beautifully, treading exactly in the footprints of the first film and of this style of film, and that annoys me, or bores me, I suspect.
Psycho doesn't. Invest in a main character, and then spoilers, the main character dies.
That's probably not the one. That's probably not the one to bring up. Yes. So basically,
executive decision with Wesley Snipes. No, Steven Seagal.
Not seen that.
So, anyway, How to Train Your Dragon 2, which should have been more like Psycho. Anyway, all right. Anyway, it is a very good film. We better move on. How to Train Your Dragon 2 opened a couple of weeks ago and is screening at both Cambridge Multiplex Cinemas. Cinema certificate PG, I believe. For slightly darker violence. As is customary for animated features, it is available in both 2D and 3D. I saw 2D, but I suspect the 3D's spectacular with all those. Nobody gets to see 3D any longer, which is a shame. I'm sure they worked very hard on it.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
You are indeed... Oh, hello. You are indeed listening to Cambridge 105 on... listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105 FM, community radio in your city. My name is Toby Miller, and joining me in the studio are Jenny Colley, Simon West, and Phil Yates. We're going to skip ahead to the review because I've accidentally gone and lost the pre-recorded piece that I had. Hold on a moment. We're going to skip ahead to the review of Begin Again. We'll go ahead to that. The modern movie musical offers such glamorous sophistication at the happy-go-lucky let's-put-the-show-on-right-here joie de vivre of the genre has been somewhat lost. Writer-director John Carney did tap into it with his 2006 surprise hit film Once, a part of the improvised musical set around Dublin. Carney's new film, Begin Again, hopes to locate the same loose-limbed charm, only this time he swapped musicians for movie stars and upgraded the city to New York. Begin Again stars Mark Ruffalo, at his most Gruffalo-like, as Dan Mulligan, a record producer who was once the toast of the New York music scene. But now, his cutting-edge dulled by the banal chart-toppers he can't comprehend, he's jobless and almost homeless. A midnight ramble takes him to a Manhattan bar where he overhears the open mic session of a young singer-songwriter played by Keira Knightley. He recognises a spark of genuine show-stopping talent in a heartbroken ballad and sets about trying to convince her that she should be recording an album. Phil, we're going to skip the trailer as I seem to have mislaid all the audio rather foolishly on this new system, I don't know. I'll put it in for the podcast. Begin Again has been sold as the style of romantic comedy without a care in the world, the sort of thing that populates the multiplex every day of the week. But as a writer and director, John Carney is trying to make a film more complicated than that. I felt anyway. How did you take it?
Well, I thought as writer and director, Begin Again was probably a note he should have taken for sort of rewriting the film rather than using as a title, because I just thought this was a very bland, nice film, but didn't really have any substance to it. And I imagine a lot of people will enjoy it. It's, you know, a summer film. You can go to the cinema and switch off for an hour and a half. But I thought there was very little actual comedy in it. I didn't think it was funny. The only character I thought was funny was the brief appearance by the rap artist midway through the film.
CeeLo Green?
Yeah.
The one that comes on and does an intentionally bad rap with his bodyguard beatboxers.
Yeah, that was really funny. And that was the sort of the one laugh-out-loud moment for me. But all the emotion was just sort of bland. It wasn't really romantic. There was no sort of drama in it. I mean, at one point, the Mark Ruffalo character says to the Keira Knightley character, until I'd... Your song that I heard tonight saved me from committing suicide, whereas it looked as if he'd just been having a bad day, and he didn't look, you know, he looked a million miles away from somebody who was about to jump in front of an underground train. I just found very little to be engaged by it, and trying to think of some positives. Keira Knightley apparently does sing the songs herself, and she obviously can sing, assuming that that's
she's sung in films before. I don't know why everybody's so surprised. Probably marketing telling them to be surprised. But well, she sang in Edge of Love, so...
Yeah, I mean, whether that's, you know, whether the music has been messed about with subsequently, as obviously they can do with people's voices, I'd like to see her go on tour and perform these songs live and see if she could still do it then. But the music was bland as well. And, you know, I think if you're comparing it to a film such as, like, Inside Llewyn Davis, which in a sense is the same kind of film. It's about a struggling musician who's trying to make it big. The songs...
Oh, I don't... No. This is... Inside Llewyn Davis is about the mediocre, being just good enough to know you're mediocre, and the pointlessness of the industry in many respects. I don't think Begin Again has got many, many themes going on. I can't believe I'm going to have a go at Boyhood but defend this. But I found there... It's a mess. It's a mess of a film. But I found there was much more to it. It was trying to do. It was striving to do. It failed dismally on many counts. Mm. But this isn't the usual sort of Meg Ryan, Tom Hanks sort of thing that I think many audiences might have been expecting. It's got some points to make, clumsily, maybe. It's certainly in some cases. It makes some interesting points about the music industry. It makes... And I think it's going after... And I'll come to Simon, I'll come back to you, Phil, but it has an air of, again, clumsy air, but it has an air of reality. It's trying to have its cake and eat it. It's trying to have these big budget stars, as big budget as Mark Ruffalo and Keira Knightley are, but it's trying to capture that improvised, handheld feeling that once had. Does it manage, or does it just make it into a mess of a film, or does it make it into sort of it's your own unique thing?
I think that it does work quite nicely. I'm not a fan of Once. And it's probably a little bit too amateurish, and I didn't enjoy the music or anything. I'm not, as anybody heard my Sunshine and Leith review, you know, I'm not a big fan of musicals, but I absolutely loved this. Fortunately, it sounds like I've seen a completely different film to the one Phil's just reviewed. I just thought it was absolutely adorable from start to finish. Rom-com is a bit of misnomer for this film. It's got some comedy, it's but nothing really that broad, and even the romance isn't really a romance. It is just more of a drama. It's a kind of feel-good feel to it. Excellent performances by both Keira Knightley, who I must admit I am a fan, and Mark Ruffalo again, playing his down-and-dirty alcoholic who, after losing his business he set up and living on a couch and being an alcoholic, it looks like he could definitely have killed himself that day, even if he hadn't heard the music of, you know, Keira Knightley. And again, a beautiful magical scene when he hears music a second time, because the film keeps going back and showing, like, this is what happens, and here we're going to, like, go back a little bit and show you what happens leading up to it. And the second time you've got music and you hear the arrangement in his head and everything else and the magical playing instruments, it's absolutely beautiful. But I thought it was fascinating. It's not cliched film. It's, as I say, it's a romantic comedy, but it's more about friendship and,
It's battling the cliches.
It's battling the cliches, and I think most of the time it does. It does that quite well. You don't really want them to get together, because you think if they get together it would be cliched, and it avoids cliches, and it's about being in the right time of your life and what happens and trying to make it. And I mean, the only thing bad about it, I mean, to be honest, even James Corden, who normally is a warning, was kind of good in this.
He seems to be genuine. He plays the best friend,
yeah. And you know, it seems really quite nice. But I thought everything in this film had a touch of truth to it, which I found really touching. And it had the indie vibe of being, you know, Once and all of that, with the director trying to find the truth behind it, except with slightly better acting and better songs, which I enjoyed throughout, and, you know, trying to investigate the city of New York. You know, more I really like this. I mean, I was just saying, this is a hard show this week, because I cannot pick a best film amongst all four, because I thought it was fantastic.
I think the reason I'm defending it, Phil, is, and I am nowhere as enthusiastic as Simon is, but I think because it was trying. It was trying to do something unusual. It has a fairly novel dramatic structure, which again I don't think really works. But it's about 40 minutes before the actual film, the film relationship starts, because it's because we deal with these Keira Knightley's flashback and Mark Ruffalo's flashback before that, and we start off with a meeting and then drift into these flashbacks and then come to the meeting and then finally the music part of the film starts. By that time we're already 40 minutes in or an hour in. I thought that was unusual. There's a moment I really liked early on where Mark Ruffalo, who up until this moment has been this endearing Gruffalo like drunk, and then runs from the bar with his daughter, played by Hailee Steinfeld, because they haven't got enough money to pay for the two beers they've had. And they run around the corner and they think they've escaped, and then the bartender comes and he punches Mark Ruffalo in the nose. And he could have played that for laughs, and he originally does. He starts playing the scene for laughs, but then he brings the camera back and holds on the shot of his daughter just feeling sick. And you suddenly realise this isn't a joke. This is her father being beaten up in the street. And he does that a couple of times. The scene where Keira Knightley, who's had a go at Mark Ruffalo for abandoning what she thinks is abandoning his wife, played by Catherine Keener, and then he tells her, no, she abandoned me. And it holds on her for a while, that's a while longer than is usual, and then she goes down the street and hugs him. And again, the camera holds back from that. There's moments like that I think it earns a little bit of respect, because it's trying, a little bit amateurishly, I think, but it's trying to be something different and do something different. But the point it's making about the music industry, I'm speaking to you from, I know from your Facebook feed that you're as interested in music as you are in films, but the point it's making about the music industry are rather cack-handed and clumsy, really. I mean, it's making a point where Keira Knightley says at the beginning, I think you hear music with your ears, you don't take it in with your eyes, why do I need to do this video sort of thing? But that's undermined by the fact that she's being played by Keira Knightley.
Exactly. And everybody's perfect, and everything in the film is perfect. I mean, the songs that they make all sound perfect, despite the fact that they're recording a track within 5 feet of a thundering underground train, and somehow we're meant to believe that this is actually going to sound really good. And you don't need a recording studio. Let's be radical and just go out there on the street and record with found sounds. And I'm just thinking there's a reason why people don't do that, because it actually sounds rubbish at the end of the day. And there's a scene where her and Mark Ruffalo are sharing each other's music on their iPods as they're walking around, and they're all very embarrassed because, oh, I don't want to show you my guilty pleasures. And, of course, all the music are classic songs that nobody... There's no I've Got a Combine Harvester by the Wurzels turning up on their iPod or anything like that. It's just all too nice. And so I can completely understand how... I'm sure this will be a very popular film that a lot of people will enjoy. It's a perfectly nice film. It's just that I thought they were trying to say we're radical and we're fighting against the music industry, and yet everything in the film was the total opposite of that, and it was just completely safe, down to the point at which where Mark Ruffalo goes on the wagon and he has some can of soft drink in his hand and he says, oh, this tastes disgusting, and they make very careful that you don't see what brand of soft drink that happens to be. And that just sums up the film for me, is that it's trying to be radical and different, and it's just perfectly safe and very likable.
Okay. Well, Begin Again opened last weekend and is still showing at the Arts Picture House. It is a certificate 12A, and I suspect, as Phil says, it will be running, and it will run and run. We'll probably replace Bell in the terms of the running and running at the Arts Picture House. You are listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105 FM Community Radio in your city. My name is Toby Miller, and joining me in a rather chaotic studio today are Jenny Colley, Simon West and Phil Yates. Time for a customary reminder of what's still to come today on Cambridge 105. After us at 1 o'clock is Summer Saturday, which today is being hosted by Linda Ness and reports back from the Sturton Street Methodist Open Day, as well as having more on the ongoing chance to see an artist at work with the Open Studios weekend. Then at 4 p.m. we bookmark. Today their studio guest is journalist and biographer Midge Gillis. Everything Italian in Cambridge is the focus of Radio Dante at 5 p.m, whilst an evening of every type of music begins at 6 p.m. with Jason Allen, and after him, there's Club Global. That's all to come. We've still got a rather rushed 10 minutes. We'll be skipping the pre-record and going straight to the review of Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, and the pre-record will be on the podcast of the programme. So he skims down to the review of Planet of the Apes. Over the past few years, science fiction has been getting its movie mojo back. Looper, Source, Code, The Edge of Tomorrow and Under the Skin have seen the genre of ideas actually get their ideas back. The latest Brains Before Brawn science fiction is new release Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, the second prequel to the rebooted series, itself a high watermark for thoughtful film science fiction. The year is 2026. 10 years have passed since the release of the deadly pandemic ALZ-113, and the human race is a distant memory for a tribe of intelligent apes living in the woods above San Francisco, what remains of San Francisco. The community is led by the genetically super smart chimpanzee Caesar, played in motion capture by Andy Serkis and then lovingly animated by the CGI artists at Weta Studios. All Caesar wants for his extended simian family is peace and security, but this gentle life is thrown into chaos when a band of humans wander into their midst, looking to restart the nearby power plant and bring electricity to the survivors' camp crouched in the valley below.
War! You know the scary thing about them? They don't need power. Lights, heat, nothing. That's their advantage. That's what makes them stronger.
We both have families. You want to protect yours. I want to protect mine. It's our only chance for peace.
Are you aware?
No!
They are going to turn on you.
They're animals!
Caesar, you're all.
Who was that?
a good man like you.
Caesar loves humans more than apes.
If you threaten his family, he will retaliate.
Don't shoot!
Simon, Rise of the Planet of the Apes came out a couple of years ago, surprised many by focusing on character over action and being interested in ideas. Does the sequel carry on the good work, or does it fall to a sort of blockbuster madness of just being pixels fighting pixels?
It's not quite full-on blockbuster. I mean, it is a different film. You are progressing, and therefore characters and ideas to take a back step, because you've done most of the ideas in the last film, admittedly. And if you know how the story progresses overall, you at some point you're going to have to break into the battles and, you know, blockbuster violence. However, this film, I thought, yet again, probably surpassed the first one, having watched the first one right before I watched this one. I mean, for the beginning of the film, the amazing film, it's just like a classic Shakespearean story where you've got the peace-loving general Caesar, the king or whatever, who's wants the best for his community and trying to progress and survive, until a couple of outsiders walk in, and then you have the warmongering general who wants to just kill everyone, take it out. It's something straight out Shakespeare. The only difference is these are all apes, and the motion capture and the emotion characterization of these apes are absolutely fantastic. You know, I could have, they're all a lot more interesting than the humans, to be honest.
Well, is that a problem?
Because which isn't a problem, because it's a film about the apes, and the fact that it carries it off, and you are as interested in these ape characters as the humans, it's essential to this film, and they pull it off, and it is amazing.
But shouldn't there be more of a balance than that? I have no problem with the apes. They are, as you said, they're just fantastic CGI. And again, like we spoke with Dragon earlier, this is sort of a given at a blockbuster of this size.
It depends how much, you know, balance you want, because, you know, it is about the rise of the ape society, well, and the humans are the outsiders.
But you're relying on two-dimensional characters. I know that the main relationship is between...
You could say that's one of the problems is the human characters. They were two-dimensional, except they weren't two-dimensional as the trailers would let you believe either. I mean, I thought Gary Oldman was actually far better than the trailers led you believe, and actually had quite a lot of depth to it, and it did ask interesting questions about.
He's not a traditional bad guy.
He's not a traditional bad guy like he looks, and you do have the point of view of, you know, how far do you get to survive and, you know, combat and war and trying to avoid it, and I thought it did ask the questions. But amongst this, again, I thought Matt Reeves did an absolutely amazing job of shooting it.
So he's taken over because Rupert Wyatt.
First time Matt Reeves did Let the Right One In, which again is a worthy remake, a very rare thing of a foreign film, and Cloverfield. But seeing a lot of action films and a lot of blockbusters and everything like that, this has been given a higher level of care and attention than a lot of studios will probably get away with. His eye is absolutely brilliant, especially in the heavily CG scenes. And there's an absolutely bravo shot of Caesar on a revolving tank going through an attack, which is almost jaw-dropping in its complexity, and an amazing eye. And it's a lot of these touches and a lot of the directorial touches that do bring it to a level above
the
average blockbuster.
Is there? I'm worried that because 70% of the effects film is the visual effect, It can do away with a lot of the sort of Transformer-like explosions and everything, because you've got eye candy all the time in front of you, and I think that sort of placates multiplex audiences a little bit. But there isn't an awful lot sort of replacing that. You said it was Shakespearean in terms of the character dynamics, but there isn't. There isn't much more than a TV pilot worth of plot here. People go up to the jungle, turn on an electric generator, ape disagrees with ape, and there's a war. The Planet of the Apes series is a series of crazy science fiction ideas. You take out the science fiction element of this science fiction film, as in they're genetically engineered apes, it's a Western. It's not a true science fiction film. It doesn't need science fiction to exist. I found that disappointing. I expected more ideas. There's a couple ones sort of around about rebellion and how dictators take shape. But there's nothing else here. It could have been an episode, other than the plushness of delivery, which I'm not arguing against at all. It's wonderful to look at. And the CGI is miraculous. It could be an episode of Stargate in terms of actual plot mechanics and story. There isn't a story there. It's very, 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 very simple. And simple to the point where you wonder why it's taking so long to tell it. That bugged me, because this is Planet of the Apes.
It's simple, you know, I think it's simple dynamics of the characters. It is a story that you need. You know, you had the heavy prequel story and ideas, which is, you know, when they were investigating an entire area in a reboot of a film of, you know, how it all came to be. There is a lot to talk about, but this is more about leading up the battles. It is a very heavy war movie battle centred film, which means how much do you need a story? You know, plot's good, it's got it throughout most of it, maybe lose it at the end, but you know, it's enough to continue on the film. But it is a war movie and it is a film about the big battle, so it's got enough to service that. But I don't think it necessarily needs to investigate heavy ideas in this film, which you may do later on in the series. But where this story situates, it's sufficient for where this story places in the series.
It's in the fabled Empire Strikes Back moment of the series, isn't it? It's the middle one of probably a trilogy.
It sounds like more like second, four, or five.
That's another argument. How much can we invest in this when we know it's going to Planet of the Apes? We know where this all leads. We know what happens to Caesar. This is again, for all the highfalutin effects and it and the delivery, it's a prequel.
Well, I'm hoping
it's no different than the Star Wars films. We know Darth Vader eventually becomes. You know,
I'm hoping in the third one they do actually completely ditch the human actors and purely set it into creation of their own ape society, and I think they could get away with that, because the scenes where it's just the apes were just as compelling as the ones with the humans.
And the scenes with the humans and the apes did touch a little bit on what did you say, Lassie? What did you say? There's a little bit of that, which is a shame. Anyway, it's Dawn of the Planet of the Apes opened yesterday, July the 17th, and is screening at both Cambridge Multiplex Cinemas. It is a certificate 12A. That is all we have time for on the rather messy show today. I do apologise, one of the computer systems had gone down and I lost a lot of the audio. A strengthened and longer version will be available as the podcast. We'll be back on August the 2nd with Guardians of the Galaxy, Moon Indigo, Joe, and the first of our two many articles on the Cambridge Film Festival, which starts on the 28th of August. Please stay tuned for Summer Saturday, but from everybody here on Bums on Seats, goodbye.